You're listening to the Flasco Oncopod, brought to you by the Florida Society of Clinical Oncology, the voice of oncology in Florida.
Thank you for joining us for part one of the Flasco Oncopod, updates in IDHM gliomas, led by Dr. Ashley Gia Seton.
Thank you. When I talked with Flasco about updates that I wanted to consider, especially for a first webinar, I thought about really, what are the recent changes in neuro-oncology that have really made us consider practice-changing treatment for our patients? And I felt it was timely to really give an update on the IDH-mutated gliomas with the recent approval in August of 2024 of vorasidenib, as well as the June 2023 updates at ASCO regarding the INDIGO study. I felt this was a great time to really start talking to the community about what updates there are for the IDH mutated gliomas and how that affects the current treatment paradigm and where we expect to go in the future. When we think of adult type diffuse gliomas, we're really focusing specifically on today's topic, the astrocytoma IDH mutated gliomas, the grade 2 through 4, oligodendrogliomas, IDH mutant, 1P19Q codeleted, which can be graded 2 through 3. And not relevant for today's topic, but another type of glioma that many of us deal with are the grade 4 glioblastomas, which are IDH wild type per the new WHO grade classification. What you'll notice is with the WHO grade 2021 classification, there is now a grade 4 IDH mutant astrocytoma. And that's because the IDH mutation was taken out of glioblastoma with the WHO grade classification for 2021. Previously, IDH mutated gliomas could transform to grade 4, and then they were called glioblastoma IDH mutant. But that has now gone to the wayside with a goal to really homogenize the different type of gliomas and understanding that the IDH mutated gliomas are a specific type of glioma different than the glioblastomas, both in the expected response to treatment as well as the prognostic information for those tumors. The goals of treatment for gliomas are quite simple when we break it down into local and systemic control. Locally, we think of surgery, radiation, and then we start to think about some of the new additions, tumor treating fields for the glioblastoma. And then in recurrence, people think about stereotactic radiosurgery as a potential option, specifically for new areas of recurrence that are outside of the original treatment area. And then laser therapy as another option for patients where there is a recurrence that is less than 3 by 3 centimeters and in a region where a biopsy and laser ablation is possible. For systemic control, the bedrock is still chemotherapy. But more and more, you start to see targeted therapy, precision medicine as an option for patients where there are mutational markers present that may respond to treatments that may have been available in other cancers. We can now consider for gliomas as well, as long as we know that they're able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier and get enough concentration there to be effective. And then immunotherapy I place there because although we know for gliomas in particular, immunotherapy hasn't had the success that we see in lung cancer or in melanoma, there still is a lot of excitement in using immunotherapy maybe as a combination approach for these tumors. Why glioma treatment is so difficult is really because there's infiltration of the normal brain tissue. Think of these type of tumors is not being a grape and jello, but more of grains of sand. So you remove what you can see, although we know that there is microscopic tumor cells that are around that area that's been resected. And unfortunately, because of the highly eloquent nature of the brain tissue, we know that we can't just continue to remove tissue for sake of having a better extent of resection. It's just not possible because we know that patients that have significant neurologic deficits after surgery, they don't do well prognostically. So we need to be careful to preserve tissue and really keep people as functional as possible so that they can tolerate the treatments that they may receive. Recurrence, unfortunately, is common for gliomas. as well as transformation to higher grade. And we know that rapid growth can cause symptoms that are concerning for increased intracranial pressure, headaches, nausea, vomiting, cerebral edema. And we talked about the microscopic disease that we really can't capture on imaging. Molecular profiling has really come into vogue and embedded itself within the paradigm of prognosticating and diagnosing these tumors. And the reason is with gliomas, histology can be difficult to differentiate tumors. What molecular profiling can do is reduce the diagnostic inter-observer heterogeneity. You can improve the accuracy of diagnosis and increase the objectivity. We also use it to help us inform the clinical trial determination when we consider patients by improving the speed at which we determine eligibility and our goal to enroll patients that most closely resemble each other, a homogeneous data set that can improve the reproducibility that we would want to see in the real world so that when there is a drug that we think may have a benefit, we're able to then put this into the real world setting and hopefully have the same type of benefits that we see in the clinical trial arena. And outside of this work, because we know in gliomas we have limited treatment options that we can offer our patients, we need to always be thinking ahead and what options may exist outside of the standard options. In recurrence, outside of a clinical trial, we know that there are many options that are not standard. And if you ask three different neuro-oncologists what a treatment option outside of a clinical trial will be, you may get three different answers. And that's why identifying molecular alterations within that tumor is very important because there may be potential targets that you could consider for patients because we know that the treatment that we currently offer for patients, specifically in recurrence, is not good enough for the majority of patients. So this is a great way to think ahead. I list here several targeted treatment options in gliomas. And the reason is many times people think in neuro-oncology, outside of temozolomide, what options do you really have for patients? And that may be true partly where we don't have the same treatment options that other solid tumors may have. There are molecular alterations that are effectively targeted, and those are things that we really need to be considering for patients when we get next generation sequencing molecular profiling for our patients. The BRAF V600E mutation is not only eligible and beneficial for melanomas, but you can see in gliomas, low-grade gliomas, there has been benefit for those patients who receive BRAF MEK inhibition. NTRK fusions also have been really found to be targetable as well. FGFR mutations, the H3K27 diffuse midline gliomas have now had targets as well. Today, we're going to spend time talking about IDH mutation, but I leave that up there as well for you. And then in children, there are several other options that are available for patients. And you may have heard more recently about the targets for NF1 patients with selumetinib. And I leave that there for you to see. Now, unfortunately, we're having this talk because we want to highlight that since the 1960s, outside of surgery and radiation, the type of systemic therapy options have really been limited. And I can go decade by decade and show you the subtle treatments that have been provided for us to really use for our patients, but it's been few and far between. So since 2005, after temozolomide was really integrated into the standard of care for patients, it's not until 2024 where the FDA approval of vorasidenib for IDH mutated gliomas in WHO grade 2, ages 12 and older, to really show that now we have something new after all of this time to be beneficial for our patients. So I think that's remarkable in its own setting. But I want to just highlight the targeted therapy options that I showed in the prior slide so that you know that although the changes in our treatment paradigm have been incremental over the decades and maybe slower than we would like, there are options that are available for patients that we are considering. So it's not that it's just, one or two treatments, but really you have to look further into molecular profiling to consider other options for patients. The treatment landscape prior to 2023, when you heard the Indigo results at ASCO for IDH mutated gliomas, was really what I list in front of you. An oligodendroglioma who grade two, you thought of surgical resection that was followed by observation, or we consider radiation followed by PCV or temozolomide, depending on your area of practice and patient factors that may lead you to one regimen versus either. In diffuse astrocytoma WHO grade 2, again, you think of the same thing, surgical resection followed by observation versus radiation followed by temozolomide or PCV. And this decision is aided by several factors, which included the resection status as well as age. Now, what I'm alluding to in 2023 was the paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this was presented at ASCO in June of 2023, which was the Indigo study, a phase three double-blinded randomized study that looked at vorasidenib versus placebo. The glioma IDH1/2 mutant WHO grade 2 status post-resection and patients who did not have an urgent need to receive radiation or chemotherapy. There was a pre-planned interim analysis which showed that vorasidenib had significant improvement in progression-free survival, as well as time to next intervention. IDH1/2 hotspot mutations occur in various cancers, such as diffuse gliomas, and the mutation leads to an overproduction of 2-hydroxyglutarate. There can be epigenetic dysregulation and impairment of cellular differentiation and immunosuppressive tumor microenvironment. Vorasidenib, an oral IDH1 and 2 inhibitor, is designed specifically for brain penetrance, and its goal is to reduce the tumor 2-hydroxyglutarate, leading to decreased tumor cell proliferation, an increase in the tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes or TILs, and reverse the IDH1/2 mutation-associated gene expression programs. The Indigo study enrolled patients who were 12 years of age and older. It looked at IDH1 and 2 mutated grade 2 oligodendrogliomas or diffuse astrocytomas. The prior intervention was surgical resection only. They wanted to look at measurable non-enhancing disease so that one or more target lesion measured at least greater than 1 by 1 centimeter. The reason for this, they needed to be able to follow something radiographically to really understand was there a benefit or not. And per investigator, the patient was not in need of urgent radiation or chemotherapy. I think this is critical to understand because one thing that people may look at is if you have a patient that has residual tumor, aren't these people that we want to get to our radiation oncologist to treat? And that may be true for many patients. However, we know that there are patients that we follow where we felt as oncologists that this is not the patient that I want to treat with radiation and/or chemotherapy at this moment, and I want to follow closely before making that decision. So that's the type of patient that was enrolled into the study. I think that's important to understand as well. Patients were enrolled between January of 2020 and February of 2022. I show you the plot here, and I think the important thing to note from the study was the primary endpoint of progression-free survival per a blinded independent review committee. And what you see is the time to next intervention in the vorasidenib arm was not reached. And in the placebo arm, this was 17.8 months. The treatment emergent adverse events were increased LFTs, liver function transaminases. However, this was only in 6 patients, 3.6% of the voro group. And 2 patients of the placebo group, they can discontinue treatment due to treatment emergent adverse events. The limitation of the study is we didn't receive the radiographic responses and crossover was allowed. So I know we understand this and something that we need to be mindful of. But you can see here when you look at the progression-free survival, it is remarkable looking at the differences in those curves as they separate. It had a reasonable toxicity profile. And so here again, we talk about treatment interruption due to the treatment emergent adverse events. And you can see slightly higher for the vorasidenib arm, but dose reduction due to this treatment emergent adverse events were 10.8% in the vorasidenib arm compared to 3.1% in the placebo. Now I want to shift to some of the updates that were had at the Society of Neuro-Oncology conference back in November of 2024, which really provided an updated result of this INDIGO study. And this was as of the March 7, 2023 data cutoff on an additional 6 months of data from the INDIGO trial. And updates including the progression-free survival, time to next intervention, safety, additional analyses, and a median follow-up of 20.1 months. The majority of patients receiving vorasidenib remained on treatment. There was one death unrelated to treatment, and no patients were lost to overall survival follow-up. What I'm showing you here is the progression-free survival. This remained twice as high in the Vora arm compared to placebo. After the median follow-up of approximately 20 months, the median progression-free survival in the Vora arm has yet to be reached. The lower range estimate of 22.1 months as compared with 11.4 months in the placebo arm. This difference equates to a 65% reduction in the hazard for disease progression or death in favor of the vorasidenib arm. In addition, what you'll see is the time to next intervention was not estimable in the Vora arm compared to 20.1 months in the placebo arm. So, in a summary, we continue to see this significant improvement in the progression-free survival, as well as in the time to next intervention that we saw in the initial study results. This persists. Across all of the subgroups, the progression-free survival, per the blinded independent review committee, favored vorasidenib over placebo. And this is across the ages in the co-deleted and non-co-deleted tumors. So you see this across astrocytoma and oligodendrogliomas. You saw this in the patients that had less than one or equal to prior surgical intervention, or even those that had more than two surgical interventions. You saw this in those that had a more recent surgical intervention that resulted in a gross total resection, as well as those that had subtotal resection or biopsies. The only subgroup that crossed that vertical line on the forest plot to suggest no significant effect was maybe in the longest tumor diameter, less than or equal to 2 centimeters. However, there were significant limitations when measuring tumors in one dimension. The treatment with Vora, it continues to show efficacy as assessed by both the progression-free survival and time to next intervention with the longer follow-up. I think it's important to know that patients tolerate vorasidenib. The safety profile of vorasidenib was manageable, and it's consistent after 6 months of additional follow-up. There was no new safety signals. I highlight really just the ones that we need to be aware of, and that's fatigue, the increase in LFTs, gamma-glutamyl transferase. We check LFTs every 2 weeks for the first 2 months, then monthly for the first 2 years. And then you may check it every 3 months. So we're not checking labs as often as you see with, traditional chemotherapies. This can be very manageable for patients. Again, here, what I want to highlight is looking at the tumor volume decreasing after patients crossed over from placebo to receive vorasidenib. And then another secondary endpoint of tumor growth rate. The tumor volume was reduced with vorasidenib and continued to increase with placebo. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to part one of this Flasco Oncopod. Stay tuned for part two, dropping next week on the Flasco Oncopod.